Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled, Should America Build a Missile Defense System? Recorded in 2001, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, former U.S. House Majority Leader Dick Armey, director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute, Ivan England, deputy director of the Coalition to Reduce Nuclear Dangers, Stephen Young, and former director of Strategic Defense Initiative Organization and chairman of High Frontier, Henry F. Cooper, discuss whether the United States should build a national missile defense system. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Now, if you've watched this program over the 10 years that we've been on PBS, you know one thing. We talk about things that matter. We've often focused on politics and government, and if there has been agreement on one issue, from liberals to conservatives to libertarians, it is that the federal government has a legitimate role in protecting you and me from attacks from other governments. And we call that function national defense. Today's question is this: should the United States build a national missile defense system to protect all of us from foreign missiles, perhaps those with nuclear warheads? Now, those who would say yes will need to convince you of the need for national missile defense. They'll need to convince you that a system will work, that it's affordable, and that deploying such a system makes you and me better off. Those who you'll hear from who say no, or yes to a limited version, should argue convincingly that the threats from China, Russia, Iraq, and other certain rogue states are limited, that the technology is suspect, that the cost is too high, and that the benefits are low. A national missile defense system was given new life with President Ronald Reagan's 1983 speech about a strategic defense initiative dubbed Star Wars by its critics. The Bush administration scaled back the program, and President Clinton's administration scaled it back even further. As we prepare to watch a new President Bush unveil defense policy, this issue and the assumptions it implies for our relationships with China and Russia will, in my opinion, be the most important foreign policy issue as we begin the new millennium. Now, to help us understand the politics of this issue, we welcome back to our program House Majority Leader Dick Armey. Now, many of you know that he's an economist by training who became a Republican member of Congress in 1985. He built his reputation working on public housing and military base closings. He's consistently opposed tax increases, and following the Republicans' loss of the presidency in 1992, he worked to become part of the House Republican leadership. In 1994, he was elected House Majority Leader, the second most powerful position in the United States House of Representatives. From the 26th District of Texas, please welcome House Majority Leader Dick Armey. Dick, we're glad to have you here.
Well, thank you.
What is the political climate today, and what's it likely to be over the next 2 to 4 years for something as controversial as national missile defense?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of events in recent months. One, the proliferation across the country into very dangerous and unstable hands, propagated largely by the Chinese, gives us a clear understanding the threat is there. The American people take a look at the wonders of this modern electronic age, and they will never accept any contention that it's not technologically possible. And what's possible in defending your children becomes a moral imperative for the American people. The final piece of the puzzle is the acceptance of the ability to make nuclear weapons delivered by missiles obsolete is so high in the United States that even President Clinton signed into law a commitment to do that. Now, President Clinton often says things that are insincere. He quickly backpedaled from that, but the fact that he signed that tells you that this person, who more than anybody I've ever seen has his hands on the pulse of American public opinion, knew that America not only was ready for this, but requires it.
All right, what are the things that happened that might have pushed President Clinton into that? Was something called the Rumsfeld Commission, where Donald Rumsfeld and some others, a bipartisan commission as I recall, studied this issue and then came out with a report a couple of years ago. What impact do you think that had, and what basically did that commission have to say?
It had a big impact. I remember sitting on the floor of the House, one of the rare occasions when somebody not a member speaks to a bipartisan gathering of members of the House, delivering that. It was a really sobering experience for us. I think America also was sobered by that, and I think that in turn developed the public attitude that was read by President Clinton when he realized you can't stand down from that. One other thing that gives me hope, since I have been for making these horrible weapons obsolete since Ronald Reagan first introduced the idea, is we now will see ourselves with a president who believes in the technology, understands the threat, and recognizes his moral commitment to America to fulfill the promise. So I believe you and I will see us build and deploy a missile security system that will protect our children from these awful devices.
Well, I appreciate your perspective. Now, as you might imagine, Dick, we have a few other perspectives on this program, and I'm going to introduce you to a group of three gentlemen in Washington, D.C., who will be having something to say about this issue. First, let me start on the right, as you see them on the screen, is Ivan Eland. He's Director of Defense Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based public policy think tank. He was the principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office, and he's written and testified extensively about defense issues. Ivan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis.
We're going to hear what you have to say in just a minute once I hear from the gentleman sitting next to you. And sitting next to you is Stephen Young. He's deputy director of the Coalition to Reduce Nuclear Dangers, a Washington, D.C.-based alliance of 17 of the largest nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation non-governmental organizations. He's also the author of Pushing the Limits, The Decision on National Missile Defense. Stephen, welcome to the program.
I'm very glad to be here.
You're going to get a chance to talk about the gentleman next to you and his comments, and that gentleman is Ambassador Henry F. Hank Cooper. He's chairman of the board of High Frontier. They're a nonprofit, nonpartisan educational corporation formed to examine the potential for defending America against missile attack. In the Bush administration, he was director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, and prior to that, he was President Reagan's chief negotiator at the Geneva Defense and Space Talks, successfully defending SDI in talks with the now-defunct Soviet Union. Hank, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, Dennis. Pleased to be with you.
Why don't you make the case from your standpoint why national missile defense is an imperative and in what way it ought to be done from your perspective?
Well, Congressman Armey made a very good case. I thought already I'd endorse everything he said. I would emphasize, I think, as the main reason that today America is absolutely defenseless. We couldn't stop a single ballistic missile that might be launched at our shores and perhaps even territories overseas. This then gives those who don't wish us well a cheap shot, in a sense, by building ballistic missiles using technology that's 50 years old to threaten us, to intimidate us, to blackmail us. And with no defense at all, it is the weapon of choice. The intelligence community has stated that on numerous occasions, and that's one of the reasons why proliferation is occurring as it is around the world, proliferation at least of the ballistic missile. If we had a defense, then I believe that proliferation would be substantially reduced because there would be less benefit to the likes of Saddam Hussein or other leaders like that of spending a lot of money on missiles if, in fact, our defenses could frustrate them. Even more importantly, should we need to intervene in some sort of a conflict overseas, as we did in the Gulf War, it will be very important that we are able to protect not only American folks at home, but also our friends overseas. Otherwise, presidents won't be able to put together a coalition, an alliance, if you will, to stand in the way of such activities.
Hank, let me stop you there for just a second and ask you about this. Now, one of the issues that's going to come up very shortly is whether we ought to be protecting just America or its allies. But you have a proposal, and one that you've worked on for an awful long time, that is significantly different from even the things that President Clinton did agree to fund. Tell us what those proposals are as they relate to sea-based and, in some case, space-based technology versus the land-based technology, which is what we've been talking about the last 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Let me go back even longer than that. 10 years ago, I was asked by then-Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney to do an independent review of the SDI program and our arms control positions. And I recommended at the conclusion of that review that we focus on what I call the New World Disorder that was then coming into being, and what was required was defenses that would defend not only Americans at home, but also our overseas troops and friends and allies. And we proposed a global defense. And we called it GPALS in those days, Global Protection Against Limited Strikes. Not trying to defeat an all-out strike out of the Soviet Union, at least not to begin with, but rather being able to defeat a few tens of weapons, perhaps a few hundreds of weapons. That was our report went in March of 1990. In June, as you recall, Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, and we found ourselves in a conflict with Scuds and Patriots involved in January of 1991, which just reinforced the recommendations we made. So the question, and I think the idea was largely accepted. People forget now that the Congress mandated that we deploy, begin deploying defenses actually in 1991. And the proposals fell on hard times when the Clinton administration came in. But the point is that the global defense is an idea that made sense then, makes sense now. Actually, even Boris Yeltsin accepted it. And the easiest way and the cheapest way in the near term to build global defenses is using our ships that are already deployed around the world. And we believe that within 4 years, with an investment of something like $3 billion more than is already being spent to defend our troops from the sea, we could build a defense that could also defend Americans at home from the sea. In the long term, the smart way is a space-based defense. It will take a little longer now to get there than the program I left in place in January of 1993, because those programs were killed outright at the beginning of the Clinton administration, and all that exists at this point is technology activities that we'd have to reassemble and get contractors to work on. There is a place for ground-based defenses, but they come into play late in the game, generally, unless you're able to put the interceptors on the ground up close to where missiles are launched from. You can't shoot them down until they're approaching you and approaching our cities, and that makes it easy for countermeasures, decoys, and so on to frustrate the defense. It's very important to have forward-based defenses, and the easiest way to do that is from the sea and from space.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to look in just a minute at graphic number 3, and Stephen, this is something that came from your excellent article that you wrote on this topic. But before I look at that and sort of give the viewer an idea of seeing what we're talking about, let me ask you to look at what Dick Armey has said, what Hank Cooper has said. I mean, to someone who hasn't heard any other argument, we ought to just all get up and salute the flag and say, let's spend the money and get this done. What's wrong with their thinking?
Well, I mean, the real question is, what will make America more secure? I think there are lots of questions about whether or not the U.S. deploying a missile defense will actually make us more secure or not for a whole variety of reasons. President Clinton has actually set out 4 criteria he used in his decision he made earlier this year not to go ahead at this point with deploying missile defenses. And those criteria really make sense. The first is the technology. Are we ready to do this? Do we have a system that's going to work? Right now, clearly we don't. The tests largely have failed, and we're some way from proving that we can get the system to work reliably. We can do it. The technology of the U.S. is never in doubt in the long term for many ways, but right now we're not there yet, and I think we may still be a ways off from that question. Second question is the cost. Can we afford to do it? I mean, in a perfect world, we want to be defended from all possible threats. Missile threat is only one threat to us. There are a variety of other threats that might be more realistic. I mean, a country wanting to attack the U.S. might be far more likely to put a boat with a nuclear weapon on that, float it into New York Harbor, and blow it up there. So the question is it the best use of our resources to spend money to build missile defenses when there are other threats that we might be better responding to? The third criteria was the implications for arms control and U.S. security overall. Russia and China, the only two countries that currently have long-range missiles that could hit the U.S., have both been strongly opposed to the U.S. deploying a national missile defense. I think it's very clear that at this point that there's no system envisioned that could defend against a full-scale attack from Russia. They have literally over 2,000 weapons still on high alert. that could be launched at us within a few minutes to an hour or so. And it's practically impossible to have a defense against that kind of full-scale attack anytime in the near future. So if we're going to build a new national missile defense against a relatively small threat, a threat from North Korea or Iraq or perhaps China, is it worth doing that when a country that has a real threat to us right now, Russia, will be upset and might actually increase or further maintain their arsenal at our cost? And the final question is the threat itself. What is this threat we're facing? As I said, the only two countries that currently have an arsenal that can hit the U.S. are Russia and China. China's is quite small, about 20 long-range missiles. Russia's is 100 times bigger than that. North Korea, Iran, Iraq all have missile programs. Those largely are short-range missiles. None of those countries have a missile yet that could hit the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. It's possible down the future that they could, but we're working very hard to prevent that from happening through diplomatic and arms control methods. And I think in the medium term, for the foreseeable future, it makes more sense to pursue arms control and disarmament, and working with Russia and China on trying to reduce the real threat to the U.S., which is the Russia and Chinese arsenals, rather than building a missile defense that can't address those arsenals at this time.
All right. And I think that's well put. Those four criteria that you mentioned are very important, and we're going to come back to that for sure. But right now, I want to look at that graphic number three before I go to you, Ivan, because I think all of you have a copy of it up there. So if we could look at graphic number three, let's talk about what we're really doing. And I know for those of you at home, this is hard to see, but let's just say on the right, it's where the missile would be launched from the right-hand side. You see it coming up there, and there's some technology then that would pick that up. At some point after the booster phase, you would see a real warhead and probably some decoy warheads. At some point, a land-based system, which is what this is predicated on here, would pick up these incoming missiles, and then an interceptor would be put in the air and hopefully have the technology to find which one of them or ones of them were real and destroy them before they did real damage to U.S. soil. And you can see there's some space-based support of that, and there's also some ground radar and that kind of thing. Now, Ivan, if I could then turn to you. You and Cato have a position that is not exactly with either one of these things. Tell us what your position is and then relate it to what you've heard so far.
Well, our position is that we need a limited defense for a limited threat. And I agree with Stephen that the threat has been overstated by the zealous proponents of missile defense. And I'm in principle, I think we need a limited missile defense to guard against accidental launches. But I too think the main threats will come from short-range missiles off ships, both cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. And this was recently confirmed by a National Intelligence Council report, which is an independent commission that's related to or associated with the U.S. intelligence agencies. And they said that the threat would come from short-range missiles off the coast on ships. And of course, the National Missile Defense is not going to take care of that threat. Terrorist weapon. Of course, the countries would do that because they don't want to launch a missile from their home territory, because we know exactly where it comes from. And we have 6,000 warheads. We have the most potent nuclear force on the planet to respond to that. So I think we need to say it's a limited and narrow threat. And I don't agree with the proposition that we're going to make nuclear weapons obsolete. One of the problems with missile defense from day one has been the fact that it's much easier and cheaper to produce more offensive weapons, especially for a country like China or Russia that has a fair amount of resources, than it is to build defenses, especially sea-based and space-based defenses. And I don't agree that the sea-based is going to be cheaper and more easily and quickly deployed than the land-based system.
All right, I'm going to give Hank and Dick a chance to respond to that. But first, Ivan, I want to ask you this. Of the issues that Stephen mentioned, let's first of all talk about technology. Where do you see the technology today? Are we where we need to be? And also, let's talk about the cost of technology. Where are we on those two issues from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, I think any weapon system has to be thoroughly tested. And the real proponents of missile defense have just flung that to the winds. I would say that if we're building a new tank or we're building a new howitzer or whatever, we need to do developmental and full operational testing. And we've only done 3 of 19 tests, and some of those some of the testing program has been criticized for not being tested adequately against countermeasures. And I think they need to beef up the testing program. And I think, frankly, to give them credit for that, I think they're working on that. I think this could work. There are certainly questions about whether the interceptor, you know, can discriminate warheads from decoys. But I think that's why we have to test it. If this doesn't work, I'm fully willing to scrap the system. If it does work, I think we can build a limited land-based system. As for the cost, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated 100 interceptors would cost about $30 billion. And if you go up to 250, it would cost $60 billion. That's for the Clinton land-based system. If you're going into space or adding a sea-based or space-based, it's going to cost much more than that. And I'm not sure it's worth the added expense for the limited and narrow threat that we face.
All right. Before we talk to someone here in the audience and then Dick and Hank on this, let me look at graphic number 4. And on graphic number 4, what you're going to see is the amount of spending that has gone into some type of ballistic missile defense spending since 1957. So this is not a new issue. We spent $122 billion altogether. This is federal spending. Since 1962, about $120 billion. Since 83, about $68 billion. So you can see there's a lot spent in the 20 years there between the 60s and the 80s. And then the amount budgeted for this last year, it was about $4.5 billion for some of this testing and some of the other things that were going on. And you see there also the number of national missile defense systems fielded turns out to be 0. And before I go back to you, we have a gentleman here in the audience, is Sterling Burnett with the National Center for Policy Analysis. Sterling, you have a comment or question?
Both comment and question. I would comment concerning the idea that, you know, can we afford it? In this time of, supposed budget surpluses, I think if any time we can afford it is now. And the idea that we can't deploy a system because we've got more pressing matters. We don't not put locks on our home because someone might break in the window. We do multiple defenses against multiple types of attacks to our homes. We should do so as well for our nation. My question is, why are we spending so much time, it seems to me, focusing on missile defenses in the sense of rockets that shoot down rockets? We have, I think, a promising technology with THEL, which is the Theater High Energy Laser, that we're developing with Israel to shoot down missiles, and it seems to me that deploying them on ships, perhaps in satellites, at forward bases on our military reservations around the world, in South Korea, you know, where our allies are that want our help, continued help, in Taiwan, we can perhaps shoot down rockets in the boost phase, which is what you really need to do.
Okay. Sterling, thank you. Dick, let me come to you first, and you've heard all these comments now, so start with that, and then I'll get to Hank on the technology here.
Well, to a large extent, we're listening to the same debate we've been listening to since the early 80s. I would take exception with one point that was made. I'm a proponent of missile defense, and I believe that you have to have active and sincere testing, and you have to use that for development. And I, too, believe that you ought to be able to use such things as laser technology for early interception, and sea-based or perhaps space-based is the better viable alternative. And for the life of me, I don't understand why anybody would argue that fully effectively and sincerely pursuing any technology that has the promise of delivering the world from any single missile that could do the destruction that we saw in Hiroshima and Nagasaki 10, 20, 30 times over, wouldn't say this is most important thing of all. If we can do it, we ought to do it. I look at the technology, we got a little school child today sitting in school playing with their little mouse, and they hit on North Korea, and they say North Korea could launch a missile that could hit your school. That little baby should just move that little mouse and see how we'll shoot it out of the air before it even leaves North Korea. That's possible. Why in the world would we hesitate?
All right, so you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, that you believe that the technology, first of all, hasn't been tested, right? It's
never
been a land-based system that has not had the technology that Hank's going to talk about in a minute.
What I believe, for the largest extent, what testing we have done has been specifically designed to discourage further development of the idea. We need that testing that helps us understand what works, what doesn't work, and to enable the further development of the idea.
All right.
It's just impossible for me to accept, with all the technological electronic wizardry that's going on in America and the world today, that we should for a moment think it's beyond our genius to do this.
Now, the second item is cost. As an economist and as someone who is at least the Republicans are allegedly trying to control spending, do you say that the cost doesn't matter, or is there some trade-off here, benefit-cost trade-off that we ought to be looking at?
I think the cost that breaks my heart is the hundreds of billions of dollars that we have spent out of necessity over this thing called MAD. Can you imagine that our best way to support our children, protect our children, was to say to the Russians or whomever, if you do it, we'll take our vengeance? Why? I mean, I think every child, every place in the world, I don't care, American child, Russian child, Chinese child, Korean child, they should hear us adults say, with all our genius, you're safe from this. And quite frankly, I don't believe anybody can honestly argue that we have given it our best effort. And until we have, we should never even consider saying it can't be done.
All right, but you would admit that the things that Ivan and Stephen say about the other kinds of threat, the terrorist threat, to the suitcase bomb, the missile offshore that doesn't come from the homeland of, let's say, a Russia, China, North Korea, that those things are threats, and probably the system we're talking about would not cover those kind of threats.
Absolutely, and that's why I would be the first to say let's improve, enhance, and further equip with modern technology our espionage capability so that we can find out who's out there, what they're doing, what the threat is. Some ship leaving some remote port heading for the United States, a port with a device like that, we should know that before they ever lift their anchor. And we can do that if we'll make the investment into the kind of intelligence systems that will make it possible for us to secure our children's safety.
All right, one last thing before I go back to Hank. The other issue that Stephen mentioned was this. He says, look, we're in a situation where we're in a very precarious situation in the world. To some extent, some people would say it's more precarious than before the dissolution of the Soviet Union, because Russia and some of its satellite states are weaker, and consequently, you know, Putin is here and he's trying to make himself and the country look as if they're still a superpower. That by taking this step, we will actually either expose ourselves to a first strike possibility from a Russia or China, or blacking that, they will then use this as a reason to establish more and more offensive weapons. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think Ronald Reagan's genius shines through here. His first point was share it. If we develop the technology, Russia, we'll give it to you free. We want you to deploy it too. Can you imagine how it turns around? Cost, threat, pure idiocy to have us participate with everybody in the world saying, if you want to make yourself safe, we'll share what we got. I take exception to the idea that we shouldn't make a missile theater, missile defense available to, for example, the Israelis. Of course we should. Everybody that would use one of these insidious messages should get the message. America will make your evil obsolete. And if somebody over here can't afford it, we'll share it with them. Because that kind of evil has to get the message. We will not tolerate it if we have the ability to stop it.
Thank you, Hank. Now, you've heard a lot of things since you've spoken before, and let's address them, I guess, in the order that Stephen mentioned. First, talk about the technology, and second, talk about the cost, and even the technology that Sterling Burnett mentioned here as well, because I think you have a significantly different idea of what it ought to cost to do something than the numbers that we've heard bandied around and the ones that Stephen uses, which are the numbers that we usually see from the government side.
There's one thing I want to say first, if I may, before I get into that, because I think that Congressman Armey really touched on the heart of the problem when he mentioned mutual assured destruction. He didn't mention the ABM Treaty, but the ABM Treaty is built on this idea of a mutual suicide pact with the Soviet Union, which is a Cold War idea that if either side were to attack the other or even get too adventurous, some
in alliance intervention that they stood to risk annihilation from the weapons, the nuclear weapons of the other side. And we embodied that in a treaty that basically committed to keep our people vulnerable. We limited ourselves to a single site in North Dakota. And that's the origin of why the technology today is focused only on ground-based defenses, by the way, because that would represent only minor changes from the treaty. To segue into the technology aspect of this, if you go back to the figure that you referred to earlier, you'll notice that the missile that you're going to shoot at separated its warheads and everything early in its flight, and the defense doesn't come into play until very late. That means you've added the burden to the defense. If you could get closer, as the gentleman spoke of earlier, with a laser or even with an interceptor so that you could shoot the threatening rocket down as it was rising before it could separate its warheads, then of course it would be far more effective. The only problem is you can't build that kind of a defense under the terms of the ABM Treaty. You can't build any sea-based defense or air-based defense or mobile ground-based defense or space-based defense. Indeed, you can't even do the development and testing of such systems under the terms of the treaty. The only thing you can build is a single ground-based site in Grand Forks, North Dakota, under the treaty as it currently resides. And even to build the site up in Alaska, which would get a little bit closer to the potential target, North Korea, would require changes to that treaty. Fundamentally, it's my position that the treaty has long outlasted its usefulness, if indeed it ever had any usefulness. I don't believe the premises were right in 1972, and they certainly have nothing to do with the world in which we live today. And yet the legacy is that it limits us to this kind of technology. The other thing I'd say about the maturity of the technology is that we demonstrated in 1984, 1985, what is called a proof of principle for hit-to-kill technologies. Many people think of the test of a minute against a Minuteman in the South Pacific, but they forget that we launched an interceptor off of an F-15 fighter and shot down a satellite that had been in the sky for I forget how many years now in its latter days. And against the dark sky background, we proved this technology could work with far more extenuating circumstances than any defense we're talking about now. The problem you have now is engineering development. It is an engineering problem. It is not a scientific problem insofar as the hitting is concerned, if you know what to shoot at. The discrimination problem is a big problem, of course, and that's a tough problem.
And what about the cost?
The cost, you have to put things in perspective. You noted here that it's been $68 billion spent since 1983. The travesty is the bottom line there that we have absolutely no national missile defense. I note that for $2 billion, most of which came by way of the American taxpayer, the Israelis made operational an Arrow system to provide homeland defense for Israel just this past year. $2 billion is what it cost. Of course, they had the willpower and an incentive following the Gulf War to begin defending themselves if they could. And I used to have trouble defending that program, I should say, before the Congress, because the concern was, why are we doing this with Israel? Well, maybe we can buy some interceptors from Israel now. This is an engineering challenge, not a technical challenge. The cost, $68 billion, is a little bit more than we invested in the sea-based system deployed around the world, the Aegis carriers. They're operational around the world. For less than 5% of what we already have invested in that system, we can begin defending our troops abroad as well as Americans at home. But you can't do it under the ABM Treaty, to close the circle of the argument I have been making. And one more point I want to make on this, because people believe that you can't get anywhere with Russia in terms of negotiations on this subject. And Congressman Armey is absolutely correct. People forget that Boris Yeltsin said yes to Ronald Reagan's proposals on January the 31st, 1992, in a speech at the United Nations. He proposed that the SDI program be redirected to take advantage of Russian technology, and that we and Russia work together to build a joint global defense for the world community. I wrote a note on the headlines out of the Washington Post and took it out to Ronald Reagan and
gave it to him and said how sweet it is because they accepted Reagan's proposal. The disaster is that even though negotiations were going on and my deputy at SDI led the technology working group, which was talking about how we could share the research and the development on a number of technologies, for the SDI program, all of that went in the ash heap when the Bush administration went out and the Clinton administration came in. The first time Yeltsin and Clinton met in Vancouver in March or April of 1993, the Russians wanted to continue talking. The Americans didn't even know what Mr. Yeltsin was talking about, I am told, people on our side of the table. Just an absolute diplomatic disaster.
All right, let me ask you about Russia there for a second, because I know you've spent some time negotiating with the Russians in the past. For those of you who watch this show fairly often over the last 10 years, you know we've done a lot of different programs. And the first one, the very first program we taped for PBS over 10 years ago, was on strategic arms reduction, believe it or not. And the late Senator John Tower was one of our guests. I asked him what it was like negotiating with the Russians, and here's what John Tower had to say.
It's a very interesting and enlightening experience to negotiate with the Soviets. You learn very quickly that they don't give anything away. They don't make any unilateral concessions. And should we make unilateral concessions to them, they would accept them and say, all right, now what else do you have
now what else do you want to give?
And so it's a hard bargaining session, involves some hard trading. And some have described it as being similar to a chess game. I'm not a chess player. I have been instructed in the art of poker by others.
Hank, would you say it's an interesting experience?
It was indeed. I spent 5 years there, including during the time when Senator or Ambassador Tower was there and leading our START talks. It was my job to find creative ways to say no in those hard-nosed negotiations he's talking about, because the price the Russians wanted to extract was Reagan's SDI program. And that's what broke their back, fundamentally. Reykjavik was the turning point. Marshal Akhramayev, who was Gorbachev's principal advisor, told Vernon Waters it was a, I think he called it a watershed event, because they realized that Reagan was not going to give on this, and they knew that they could not compete. Gorbachev went home, wrote Perestroika, and as they say, the rest is history.
All right, I'm going to give you, Stephen, a chance to talk about that in just a second, but first a comment from someone here in the audience.
Dennis, I'm concerned that if we had been following this program in the past, we'd never gotten to the moon. Kennedy called for us to go to the moon, and 5 years later, 1968, we were on the moon. And I think the United States, having spent 16 years on this topic, with a few more billions of dollars, can get us there. And we have a $10 trillion over 10-year tax cut being contemplated. Let's take 10% of that, just $1 trillion over 10 years, and that'll keep our nation safe.
Thanks. Good comment. Now, Stephen, let me then come to you and pose you this question, and I want you to go into your feeling about the ABM treaty as an example. You have said, I think, that the technology is certainly questionable, and based on what we've seen so far, it's hard to argue with that. But if the technology were available, and secondly, if it were available at a cost that were reasonable, and that's significantly less than the $30 to $60 billion, I mean, Hank is talking about $3 billion to start on the sea-based stuff, which will do more than what the land-based would do. If you could have technology that worked at a very affordable cost, is it still a good idea, or should is it still a bad idea, or should we consider it under those circumstances?
I think the question again remains is the U.S. more secure overall? And I think the problem with technology is, yes, we can do many of these things. I mean, tests have worked in the past, but most tests have failed. And the real question is, even when this is, as they say, rocket science, it's a very, very hard thing to do. I mean, the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster is an example. We spent billions trying to get that thing just right, and the teeniest little thing causes a failure. In 1998-99, three successive Titan missile launches, launching satellites, failed in a row, costing billions of dollars in satellite technology. This is rocket science. We can do it, but can we do it reliably every single time? It's really what you need. With missile defense, you have to have that. It has to work the first time, or you wasted billions of dollars. That's the real question we have to face. There could be a time when it does make sense to do this. There could be a time when it's worth spending that money. I mean, the U.S. can definitely afford this technology. even at $100 billion or $200 billion, we can't afford that over 10 years if it's going to make us more secure. And so the question goes back to what was discussed earlier, this terrible idea of mutual assured destruction and the ABM treaty. And the real question is, that has to go away. We have to get rid of mutual assured destruction. Right now, the US and Russia and the globe are under immense threat. And the real question is, how do we get rid of that threat? You can try building defenses, you can try building a technical solution to that by having missile defenses. I would strongly prefer getting rid of the weapons themselves. We have since under Ronald Reagan and George Bush negotiated arms control treaties that have vastly reduced the threat from Russia to the United States.
Stephen, let me stop you there for just a second and put the graphic up, which is graphic 2, which has to do with the number of ICBMs and warheads that have been reduced. And it's kind of hard to see it on your television screen at home, but let's just say that what you're looking at the top is ICBMs. You look at Russia, the U.S., China, and you can see that's September 1990, reduced almost 50% from the Russian standpoint, a little less than that from ours. The submarine launch-based missiles, again, a significant reduction. And if you look at the bottom, Russia has reduced about, let's just say, 40%. The U.S. has reduced close to that, 30 to 40%. And, of course, China now has about 20 and didn't have any 10 years ago. But the fact is, what you're talking about is reducing these. And I think everyone would agree with that, Stephen, is even if you had the defenses, you'd sure like to do that as well. Now, focus for me, if you will, on whether you believe, and the coalition that you represent, believes that the ABM Treaty, negotiated in 1972 with the now defunct Soviet Union, first of all, legally, do you think it's still alive and well? And then secondly, whether you think it legally is or not, obviously some people believe that we still ought to adhere to it, whether it's legally binding or not.
I mean, the real question with the ABM Treaty is, what are the two parties' perceptions? At the present, both the U.S. and Russia maintain this is an important treaty, as called the cornerstone of strategic stability. It's a key to U.S.-Russian relations. As long as that remains the case, then we have to keep working within the terms of that treaty. I think it's very important that we can work with Russia either to modify the treaty or it may be even end the treaty. That could be a situation that we want to get into, but it has to be done cooperatively. This is about reducing the overall threat to the U.S. If we simply abandon the ABM treaty and say, Russia, we don't care what you're going to do, our security will be worse off overall. That's the real question.
And that is the real question, not just with Russia, is it, Stephen, but also doesn't China at least make some noises about how they would react if we decide to do something like this?
China is very upset about this question. They have said, I mean, the line you get from people who support missile defense is that China, no matter what we do, is going to increase the size of their arsenal, and that may well be true. But China is a country that, unlike Russia, is on the uptrend, not the downtrend. Russia's arsenal is declining almost no matter what we do. Their economy is shot, and they can't afford to build new missiles. China has been very, very slowly, over the last two decades, building up its arsenal. It has, if it so chooses, the resources to make that arsenal vastly larger, not perhaps to Russia's size in the near term, but to enough size to overwhelm any defense we could build in the medium, short to medium term. And that is a question is, would China react that way to defenses we build, either sea-based, space-based, it doesn't matter how we do it, how will China react? If we're doing it against their objections, we may end up being less secure overall.
All right, thank you. And Ivan, I'm going to give you a chance in just a second, but first I'm standing here with George Reasonover. George, tell us just a bit about your background and then make whatever comments you'd like to make here.
Yes, sir. I'm a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer, and I believe I worked for Ambassador Cooper on various nonproliferation issues when I was on active duty. And I've served in Pakistan and India, Germany, and Central and Eastern Europe, so I have some feel for the issue, and I do have a question. Stephen advocates further drastic reductions in our nuclear stockpile, and I think the conventional wisdom is that this could lead to a kind of instability as the arsenals draw down to certain levels. So my question for Ambassador Cooper, sir, would be, do you see a ballistic missile defense system enhancing this process or detracting from it?
Great question. Hank, you want to take that?
Well, I'm not sure who it is you're referencing. If you're referencing Russia as the respondee, I think I agree with my colleague's statement.
Yes, it was.
At least in part, in that Russia really can't afford a major arms race at this point in time anyway. It is true, however, though, that they are modernizing their missile force. The only, it's not the only ICBM development program or deployment program, but they're actually deploying new Topol missiles today. So it's not correct to say that they have stopped their development activities. We have no such program today, haven't had for many years. If your reference is to other countries, I would say that with respect to the Irans, Iraqs, Libya, Syria, North Korea, if we build defenses and demonstrate that they are affordable and that they are effective, then I think it will be a deterrent to the proliferation issue that you brought up. And I don't think that they'll pay the price of building a lot of weapons. China is a different case, and I would argue that we should not make the same mistake with China that we made with Russia. It was assumed in 1972 that with the signing of the ABM treaty that there wouldn't be a major buildup of Russian missilery. It turned out to be absolutely false. It didn't stop the buildup in missiles. It didn't stop the MIRVing. In fact, Harold Brown, who was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Defense, said, "We build, they build, we stop, they build." That was the bottom line. And it had nothing to do with it. What stopped that buildup in that race was SDI, believe it or not. I think the case will be clear by historians that look into this fact. Ms. Fitzgerald's book, notwithstanding, it was not fantasy, it was real, it is real, and the thing that's in our way from exploiting that technology is the ABM treaty.
All right, thanks. And let me get a quick comment here from the audience, and then Ivan, I'm to you. Go ahead, Dan.
Dennis, I think that Stephen answers his own questions in two respects. First of all, if the Chinese and Russians, the fact that they don't want these systems to be built is proof that they must feel that they have a good chance of working. Otherwise, why would they care? They just say, hey, go ahead, U.S., spend all this money. We're not worried about it. That's the whole reason that Gorbachev was concerned when Reagan proposed in the 80s. Secondly, the fact that the Chinese program is on the uptick gives us all the more reasons why you should build the system, not less of a reason to do so.
Thanks for that comment. Now, Ivan, you've heard a lot of things since you've spoken to us last. I want you to address that. And also, I want you to address one of your key points, I think, which is, should we build, let's assume that we have the technology, assume we can get it at a fairly affordable rate, and assume, and all these are big assumptions, assume that China and Russia may growl and grunt and all that, but they're not going to unleash a first strike attack against us if we start doing something. Should we build it so that we preserve our own homeland or try to do it globally to take care of our allies and other things like that? Because I think you're concerned about our getting into conflicts around the world thinking that we're safe at home.
Well, I would not build it for other countries. I think that's we spend too much money on defending other countries already. And I'm certainly for building theater systems to defend our troops. And I'm also in favor of a system, if it works, of defending the United States with a limited land-based system. I'd have to take, I have a little difference with Ambassador Cooper in the fact that I don't think that the sea-based is more capable than the land-based, and I also think it's not very cheap. The Navy is going to require dedicated ships, and I just know that. I used to be a naval analyst, and also they're going to have to convert a mid-course system into one that hits the missiles in the boost phase, because even Frank Gaffney, who's a big proponent of the sea-based system, has admitted that the initial modifications to the sea-based systems are not going to take on the long-range missiles, the fast missiles, even from North Korea or Iran or Iraq. So I think, and plus, the people who want to go to sea, they're really going to end up, it's insufficient, so they're going to have to go into space, and that's going to cost a whole lot more money. So I think what we need to do is, I don't share Stephen's concerns as much as he does about the arms control. I agree with Ambassador Cooper that we could negotiate with the Russians. I am not for scrapping the ABM treaty, but I do think we ought to renegotiate it with the Russians, and I think they will exchange deep cuts in offensive weapons for a limited missile defense because, as has already been mentioned, their nuclear stockpile is already deteriorating. So I see a settlement that could be reached there where we can have a limited missile defense that will defend the U.S. And I think a lot of the people who are ardent proponents of this, Robert Kagan being one, has admitted that this is not to defend the United States, the big systems. It's really as a, to be used as an intervention shield so we can intervene overseas against these countries. And I think that's very dangerous because these defenses, even the thick ones that Ambassador Cooper is talking about, they're not perfect. And if we intervene, they launch a missile. What if it gets through? Is Chicago or Los Angeles worth intervention somewhere in the third world?
There's no question that's a problem. Ivan, thank you. We're going to lose our satellite feed in about 30 seconds. So, Stephen, let me give you 15 seconds to make any remarks that you may not have had a chance to do so far.
Just on your last viewer's comment, I mean, the point is, if China is ticking up, as you said, will they tick up even more if we build defenses? Are we going to be more secure with defenses or less secure, strangely enough, in this odd nuclear world we live in? I argue you're safer actually being undefended because they will attack you more if you try and defend yourself.
Thank you. And Hank, I give you the last comment before we lose the satellite feed.
Well, I think that we can do it. I think the technology's mature. It's an engineering job. We've done things like this before, and we should make it work. But we need to get to intercept early in a missile's flight, and you can't do that with the Clinton system. You've got to have forward basing, and I think from the sea and from space is cheaper and more effective.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Now, you have a comment, I think, for Dick Armey.
Yeah, Dick, I must agree that I do believe in your two of your points, one being that it is predominantly very important that we focus on all the threats, whichever route they come from, and that also that the focus must be that this is very paramount to our children, but that I disagree with the funding aspect of it. And what if we took the funding aspect out of the equation and took it to private industry, which has frequently demonstrated that it can tackle these technical tasks, and put it to private enterprise to fund the whole thing? And therefore, if there was no cost related to taxpayers and the whole thing was funded, there would be no money we put into the whole thing, as Harry Brown has believed.
Well, a couple observations. First, if I'm a burglar watching this show, I'm going to Steve's house right afterwards. secondly, I think we ought to use our private sector genius. It is so much greater than our public genius or lack thereof. We ought to rely on the genius. The national defense is and probably always will be one of these indivisible groups that is hardly profitable for the private sector to undertake. But on the other hand, I'm just sitting here watching this process. We have just watched ourselves sit in the studio and talk to people in Washington, and up there in the magic sky is a satellite that picked us up here, picked us up there, maybe with contributions from neighbors like ourselves, people who believe in quality transmission. We might put another satellite up there that just says if Washington launches a missile at Dallas, Texas, we'll spot it, intercept it, and shoot it out of the air. but I do think that the funding probably has to be a public process just because of the sheer indivisibility of it. And I think that's my job. You all hire me to watch your tax dollars. Well, Dick, a lot of things I could spend them on.
Let me ask you about
this. This is one that I would do so willingly.
Let me ask you about the tax dollars, because in a lot of cases, it is private corporations that get the government money, and people get socked in. I don't know if there are contractors in Grand Forks, North Dakota, people in Alaska. I mean, you have congressmen from Alaska and North Dakota and Texas and Mississippi and other places who want these dollars spent in their backyard. I'm sure that never enters into these decisions in Washington, does it?
It does. And that's a problem. And when, you know, I got into this rap when I did this business shutting down military bases, and I said, look, it should not be a matter of this nation's concern that you want to create jobs in your congressional district. And when you come to something that's so critical as applying the best of our science and engineering to protecting our children, our communities, I would think that any member of Congress that lacked sufficient dignity to put his congressional job's circumstance ahead of the nation's interests should at least be disciplined by a more well-informed majority that has a more serious sense of purpose. And I must say, since Ronald Reagan tried to create this miracle in the lives of our children in the early 80s, all of Washington has been much more generous with lip service than they have been generous with sincere research dollars. And if we had been, if we would have the commitment to apply our real genius to this process, this is altogether within what is capable for us on a regional basis, on a theater basis, on an intercontinental basis. If there's an evil in the world, America should be the first to stand up and say, we're going to eradicate that evil. And these missiles and these delivery systems are evil.
We hope you guys all across the aisle can pull this off, because this is a big, big issue. And I thank you for being here as well. Now, our hope is that you'll do this right now. Call or write your elected federal representatives and let your opinions be known. Read the web pages of the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Coalition to Reduce Nuclear Dangers, and stay informed. Thank you for inviting us in to talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.